Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the 2019 primary elections. Parents in the Gary Community School Corp will have a choice between two middle schools. Samantha Horton reports on the impact tariff increases will have on the state. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Tyrus Josephorski, founder of Hometown Country Jam. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Jerome Prince scored an upset victory in defeating incumbent mayor Karen Freeman Wilson in Tuesday's Democratic primary for mayor of Gary. Michael Puente has more.
Jerome Prince was one of nine candidates in a crowded field, but collected nearly half of the more than 14,000 votes cast in Tuesday's primary. He collected 1,500 more votes than runner-up Karen Freeman Wilson, who was attempting to win her third four-year term. Prince thanked his supporters at a victory party at his campaign headquarters on Broadway in Gary's Glen Park neighborhood.
This was a race about the people. The people spoke loudly. They said they were ready for change. They believed that I could be that change agent, and to that extent, we're here.
Prince so far does not have a Republican challenger in November's general election. I'm Michael Puente.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The defeat of two longtime Hammond Council members in the Democratic primary points to a new era in city politics, with the council poised to become more representative of the electorate and even friendlier to the mayor's office. In a pair of stunning victories Tuesday, first-time council candidates Barry Tyler Jr. and Katrina Alexander unseated the council's two longest-tenured incumbents. The Times reports Tyler made perhaps the biggest splash of the primary night, easily defeating District 3 Councilman Anthony Higgs, who has held the seat since 2003. Alexander finished third in the race for Hammond's three at-large seats, knocking eight-term Councilman Bob Markovich out of the running for the general election. Some influential Lake County Democrats say the election results in Hammond mark a tipping point in favor of younger, less experienced candidates. District 5 Councilman and Hammond Democratic Party Chair Dave Warpel said it was no surprise that Markovich and Higgs, with nearly a half century on the council between them, were the incumbents unseated by 30-something challengers. The Times reports, in the at-large contest, all of the candidates ran on core issues of economic development and safety. But Alexander, a teacher at East Chicago Central High School, centered her campaign with youth-centric proposals such as funding mentoring programs. One outstanding question is how the council's relationship with Mayor Thomas McDermott Jr. would change if Tyler and Alexander win the general election. Higgs and Markovich have composed something of an informal anti-McDermott faction over the years, balancing the mayor's numerous council allies, including Warpel, Venice, and Dan Spittle, Democrat at large. While the Hammond Democratic Organization did not endorse a slate of candidates for the primary, McDermott enthusiastically backed Tyler's campaign to unseat Higgs. If Tyler wins in the general, the days of animosity between the mayor's office and District 3 are likely to come to an end. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The executive director of the Gary Redevelopment Commission has resigned effective immediately. Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson announced the resignation of Joe Van Dyke Thursday. He served the city of Gary since 2012 as executive director of the Redevelopment Commission and as director of planning and zoning director. During his time with the city, Van Dyke managed economic development initiatives such as the relocation of Alliance Steel to Gary, led the Gary Parcel Survey, the Gary Counts Initiative. He also helped oversee the city's blight elimination program, including the Sheridan Hotel demolition and hardest hit fund program. Mayor Freeman Wilson says Van Dyke has been an integral part of the Gary team for the last 7 years, and he has been extremely effective in managing a number of economic development initiatives. He is leaving the city to experience new opportunities and to move closer to family on the West Coast. He will remain with the city through September on a part-time basis to complete the city's comprehensive plan update. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Parents in the Gary Community School Corp will have a choice between two middle schools, each with dedicated programming for their children in grades 6 through 8 to attend starting in August. On Thursday, the Indiana Distressed Unit Appeals Board, which acts in lieu of a locally elected school board, unanimously approved a plan by the district's state-appointed emergency manager to establish a second middle school in Gary in response to parental concerns. The schools will be located in the current Gary Middle School, housed in the former Benjamin Banneker Achievement Center in the city's Miller neighborhood and in the Bailey Preparatory Academy in the Glen Park neighborhood. Middle school students initially will be assigned to one of the buildings based on their home address, but parents can request their child attend the other middle school if it is more suited to the student's academic interests. Specifically, the Gary Middle School will be arts-focused with specialized classes in performance arts, music, and dance, while the middle school at Bailey will be a STEM academy offering additional courses in science, technology, engineering, and math. Both schools will also have a standard middle school curriculum as well as computer science programs. Emergency manager Pete Marekis says both schools will also have a standard middle school curriculum as well as computer science programs. Current elementary students at Bailey will be relocated to the nearby Glen Park Academy.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Gas prices have been soaring across Northwest Indiana, rising by 12.5 cents per gallon in the Gary Metro since last week, according to gas price tracker GasBuddy.com. The Times reports the price of filling up a tank has increased by 19.7 cents per gallon over the last month. The average price of $3.08 per gallon in the Gary Metro, which encompasses most of Northwest Indiana, is 22.8 cents per gallon higher than a year ago, with the cheapest gas at $2.80 per gallon. Gas prices have been rising for a number of reasons, including rising crude oil prices, decreases in production at Midwestern refineries during the spring maintenance season, and the switch to the more expensive summer blend that burns cleaner to reduce emissions by the busy travel season. But the biggest reason for the spike is that the weather is warming up and people are driving more, including going on road trips.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed into law Wednesday legislation that makes seismic shifts in Indiana's gaming industry. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Holcomb's decision came with a midnight deadline looming.
The bill opens the door to Indiana's first new casinos in a decade. One would be in Gary, moving an existing facility to a new, more desirable location in the city. If that happens, it also clears a path for a new casino in Terre Haute. The measure also potentially allows gambling in every Indiana community. That's by legalizing sports wagering, including online and mobile. In a statement, Governor Holcomb says, quote, "By modernizing our laws, this legislation will spur positive economic growth for our state and for an industry that employs over 11,000 Hoosiers." Holcomb cites increased competition from other states as a need for the bill, and he says the measure will bring in new revenue and create jobs. The bulk of the bill becomes effective July 1st. Casinos can begin offering sports bets September 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill announced Monday the state is suing credit agency Equifax. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the suit follows an investigation into a 2017 data breach.
The 2017 data breach compromised the private information of nearly 4 million Hoosiers. And Attorney General Curtis Hill says he's suing in part because that breach was preventable.
Long before they got hit by cyber attackers in 2017, it is our contention that Equifax knew full well that they had gaping holes in their cybersecurity systems.
Hill says part of the suit seeks to force Equifax to fix its ongoing security issues. And Consumer Protection Division Director Betsy DiNardi says the state also wants to get help for victims of the breach.
It's our contention that Equifax should repay those Hoosiers for the credit monitoring services that they paid for.
Two other states, Massachusetts and West Virginia, similarly filed lawsuits against Equifax over the 2017 breach. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A newly signed law will provide more structure for opioid treatment providers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports, the move aims to ensure Hoosiers who need medication-assisted treatment are receiving comprehensive care.
Methadone is highly regulated in Indiana, but providers who prescribe another medication called Suboxone or buprenorphine haven't been held to the same standards. Republican Senator Aaron Houchin says some of the state's office-based opioid treatment or OBOT facilities need more regulation.
Rather than just prescribing Suboxone for people to take and walk away with without actually treating the root cause of the substance abuse addiction.
The number of OBOTs has grown to more than 600 in recent years. The new law will require providers to include counseling, drug screening, and prescription monitoring, as well as medication-assisted treatment. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed a bill into law this week that will fund adult high school diploma programs based on performance, not just enrollment. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports the requirements will affect programs across the state.
The new law establishes the Workforce Diploma Reimbursement Fund. It lets programs that award adult high school diplomas apply for a reimbursement of up to $6,750 per graduate. To be reimbursed, the programs must also maintain a graduation rate of at least 50%, among other requirements. Indiana Republican Senator Jeff Rotz authored the bill.
And the best part about it is that there's no payment up front. When the students earn credits, that's when the organization is paid.
The governor's workforce cabinet must approve every diploma awarding organization prior to reimbursement. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
President Donald Trump is threatening to boost tariffs on imports from China up to 25%. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, U.S. businesses are warning the increase will hurt them and consumers.
A coalition of retailers and farmers says Indiana could lose up to 15,000 jobs if additional tariffs go into effect for 1 to 3 years. Laura Boffman is president of the Trade Partnership Economic Think Tank. She says businesses will have to act to protect their bottom lines.
We're at that point where all of the companies that have spoken previously to me they just can't absorb anymore. They just can't put off firing people anymore.
Higher tariffs would increase prices on products including luggage, electronics, and infant cribs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb presented a ceremonial check Thursday to celebrate the funding of a connection between two trails in northern Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it's part of the first round of grants awarded by the state's Next Level Trails initiative.
It's also a lifestyle changer in the sense that it's promoting healthy living, it's promoting safety, and then it promotes all of our pleasing natural beauty and assets.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
When health researchers make headlines, it's often for a sensational project like manipulating genes to create a baby. But others are examining broader issues, including how and where you live affects your health. Jill Sheridan of Side Effects Public Media reports on a project to help understand how all of the pieces of the health puzzle fit together.
That health puzzle covers your habits, culture, social life, and much more. And it helps determine whether you get serious illnesses like cancer, diabetes, or a heart attack.
The social environment can either turn on protective genes or it can turn off protective genes. And so social factors like loneliness, social factors like childhood traumas, these things have been scientifically shown to affect whether or not they're going to get certain kinds of diseases.
That's Indiana University professor Bernice Pesca-Salido, who leads the person-to-person health interview study. She says it explores the next level of a person's health makeup.
We really need that interaction for this next phase of science, which looks at them as a whole person, not just the disease in the body and the bed.
And that's why field interviewer Paula Williamson has come to a northern suburb of Indianapolis.
We are in a neighborhood of modular homes in Noblesville.
Williamson gets out of her big black pickup. She's been knocking on doors for the past few months, asking people about a lot of things related to the study. Family history, lifestyle, mental health, drug use, child experiences, financial stability, and their community. She also asks for DNA samples. The genetic material will be analyzed and calculated with the survey research. Williamson says people have been very open.
There's part ownership in this project that people want their voices to be heard.
On another day, Williamson is on the south side of Indianapolis at the apartment of Sandra Jo Edwards. When Edwards received an invitation to participate in the study, she threw it away.
I just thought it was just something, you know, that come from, you know, wherever. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do this.
But when Williamson rang her doorbell, she started thinking about her parents and her family health. Both of Edwards' parents had cancer. Her mother is a survivor. Her father passed away.
You know, my father, I mean, he just did it himself, though. You know, he didn't want to go do the treatments or anything like that.
Her information will be compiled with thousands of others to give a clearer, deeper look at why one person develops a health condition and another does not. This type of research is growing, says Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association.
And if you think about that, it makes a lot of sense because where you live determines access to schools, jobs, access to food sources, a range of social activities, whether you have walkable, bikeable communities with parks, playgrounds.
He says if you ask what people need for healthy lives, you might be surprised by their answer.
Our priority right now is figuring out how we can get a bus stop in our community so that we can get on the bus and we can go to work. And you can't engage that community until you fix that transportation problem.
Professor Pesca-Salido says solutions that follow the Indiana study will take the whole person into account.
Because even if you come up with the most brilliant prevention strategies, if the people who you're targeting don't want it, don't like the way you're doing it, it's going to be useless.
This type of study focuses on what researchers call the social determinants of health. And Benjamin says it has an even broader impact, just like healthy behaviors are a personal responsibility.
When we talk about the social determinants, we're talking about that community responsibility to help our neighbors and ourselves be more healthy.
The person-to-person study is part of a larger Indiana University initiative with ambitious goals. By the year 2020, it aims to cure at least one cancer, one childhood disease, and find a preventative solution to a chronic illness. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Tyrus Josephorski, founder of Hometown Country Jam.
Coming up here on June 1st at the Bricky Bowl, the historic Bricky Bowl, I guess we should say, because actually, if for anybody that doesn't know, the Bricky Bowl was built back in the 1930s. It was a WPA project. So that puts it in just in the, I guess, in the Depression era, more than World War II era, I suppose. But that's how the Bricky Bowl got started. Of course, it's the scene of been many, many, many high school football games over the years with the Hobart Brickies. And now it's going to have another life, I suppose, in a way, as being what is hopefully going to be a continuing venue for the Hometown Country Jam Country Music Festival. And we have with us the fellow who has created everything. Well, not the Bricky Bowl. It was already
not
there.
Not the Bricky Bowl. That's way before me.
But the Hometown Country Jam is his idea. Tyrus Josephorski. Has created Flight Levels Entertainment. That's you had to basically create your own business, I suppose, to be able to get this thing off the ground?
Yeah, essentially. And there's some meaning behind that name,
okay,
too.
Okay, well, tell us about that.
Well, actually, so by trade, I'm actually an airline pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So Flight Levels, that kind of where
that
all that
sense.
Came from.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the idea came from for the Hometown Country Jam. I was flying along with a captain one night, 35,000 feet, and he actually used to be a country touring artist. And light bulb just went off, and I was like, country music festival. That would fit in perfect here. So that's kind of where it all started, and that was probably back last June now, so year from when the event will be.
What got you into thinking that a good venue would be the Bricky Bowl?
Well, there's a few things. One, obviously, the historicness behind it. It appeals to a lot of people, this bringing life back to it. People are excited about that. You know, there hasn't been anything really done there in almost 10 years, and the city put almost $1 million into it. So they renovated all the bleachers. So there's that aspect, just the hype behind that. And then location itself. Within Northwest Indiana, we have almost 1 million people here. And Hobart's so centrally located that it's a 20-minute drive from everyone. So I saw a lot of value in that. So that's one of the reasons, multiple reasons, we want to do it at the Bricky Bowl.
And obviously, besides the opportunity to take advantage of a ready-made venue, because you have lots and lots of bleacher space and lots of space on the ground for not only the stages, but for spectators as well, too.
Absolutely.
How much help would you say the city of Hobart has offered up here, besides the actual work on the structure itself, which they've done with money they've had available over the years?
Yeah, nothing but amazing things to say about them. Mayor Snedeker and Events Director Nikki Lopez, HPD, they've all been fantastic. So essentially, when I came to originally Councilman Josh Huddleston with this idea, he was like, absolutely, I need to get you in contact with the mayor. So we all sat down and talked about this. I kind of laid him out a plan, and they're like, let's do this. You know, they put all the money into the Bricky Bowl. A lot of people want to see life come back to the Bricky Bowl. And they've been amazing when it comes to permitting, et cetera. I mean, they're handling kind of all that behind the scenes, like state politics stuff. It's a huge relief off my shoulders. And they really just want to see Hobart grow. And they want to see, you know, these kinds of acts and entertainment value coming into the city. So they've been fantastic.
Well, let's talk about the entertainment that's going to be coming up here for the Country Music Festival itself on June 1st. And I guess there are some stories, at least one in particular, that we should look into here involving one of the performing acts, or I should say a gentleman who is representing a performing act in his own right, we understand. Montgomery Gentry is one of the highline performers for the show that night. Tell us about Montgomery Gentry, which is actually the name of a group, but it's now become one sole performer. Tell us about him.
Well, I'd actually say it's still a group. Mm-hmm. That band itself has stuck together for many, many years, and they've been stuck together since, you know, the death of Troy Gentry. And they're an amazing group of guys. And, you know, they've been around for 20-plus years. They've had 5 number one hits, 10 top 10 singles. So they've been around the block, and everyone knows the name. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring them in. And I went and actually saw them in Shipshawana a couple months back, and man, they rock. They're fantastic. So essentially what they do now is Eddie Montgomery, the surviving member of the duo, he still sings his normal parts, and the rest of the band then picks up Troy's parts. And they sound fantastic. So they're really, really doing, you know, amazing for Troy's memory. And I think people are going to be really excited to see him.
Devin Dawson is one of the other performers who's involved in country music, of course, in Nashville. Tell us about him, what he's done, and what he's going to bring to the event.
Yeah, Devin, he took off here really last year. He had a major year. He had a hit single, All On Me. It's at over 100 million streams on Spotify alone. That's not counting iTunes or anything else. He actually got his fame from a Taylor Swift cover he did, and Taylor Swift just retweeted it, and people blew up. You know, they loved it, and they loved him, and then he came out with his hit album, Dark Horse, which is the song Dark Horse is what's on the radio now that people would recognize. But he's awesome. He's kind of, they call him the country music dark horse, you know. He's kind of like a gothic. He wears all black when he performs. All his Instagram posts are in black and white. It's a really cool vibe that he puts off, and he's put a country twist to it all, and it's really fun.
Do you think he's going to be the next man in black? he's vying for that honor?
I think he has a very, very good opportunity to continue to take off in country music and be a major player in the years to come. Okay.
One of the other performers coming up for the Hometown Country Jam Country Music Festival that's going to be held in Hobart at the Bricky Bowl on June 1st is an artist who is known by only one name.
Fillmore, yes. So he was Tyler Fillmore, and then they took the first name off of it, and he became just Fillmore. He's another amazing up-and-comer. He gained his fame on Spotify as well, millions of listeners and followers every month. He's kind of more of a poppy country artist. So when I built this lineup, I wanted to hit every type of type of country you could think of. Montgomery Gentry, the old legacy act who everyone knows, everyone loves, you know, hit songs. Devin Dawson, he's his own style of country music. Fillmore is the poppy country artist. Because I wanted to appeal to everyone. And Fillmore, he really appeals to the younger urban crowd. And he puts on an awesome show, man. He is fantastic.
Now, does it seem that the next performer that's on the bill, Noah Guthrie, is he more like what we consider, if not a traditional country singer, maybe an old school country singer?
He's kind of got a really raspy voice, and it just sounds amazing. He was on America's Got Talent, and he placed second, I believe it was last year. Mm-hmm. And he really took off on social media, and people really, really appealed to him. Originally we had artist Abby Anderson on the bill, but she got put on a major tour, so unfortunately we had to sacrifice our rights for her to perform as she was going to be on a major tour this summer, and we wish her nothing but the best. So I kind of wanted to have that female aspect to the festival. Mm-hmm. So when we lost her, you know, it was kind of a bummer, but Noah Guthrie is nobody to sleep on. He's amazing.
That's great. There's a reason that we have all these big name acts, up and comers and the like, that are performing. Opening the show on June 1st is going to be a local person, and that's as intended. Tell us how the idea of having somebody from Northwest Indiana, number one, on the show is planned, and there's a reason behind it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. So local is big to me. You know, I grew up here. This is my area. And we want to give the local artist a chance to grow and be seen. So our local artist, Jay Wacasey, union steel worker, I was like, man, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, that fits in perfect to the region, to the hometown. And that's why we called it, you know, the Hometown Country Jam, because this really, I want everyone to be proud of it. I want them to feel passionate about it. And this is their hometown. So.
All right, let's get to some of the basic info that everybody should know if they're interested in going to the Hometown Country Jam coming up on June 1st at the Bricky Bowl in Hobart. Number one, when's the festival start and end?
So it's on June 1st. Doors open at 3 p.m., and then they're closed curfews at 11 p.m., so it's all day. Mm-hmm. We have almost 20 food vendors who are going to be there, everything from Puerto Rican food to pierogies to barbecue. And I think people really like that, as these summer markets and stuff are just taking off. So we wanted to bring that appeal to it. Once again, it just appeals to that hometown feel. It's all ages event. So we have the kids zone, you know, inflatables, bounce houses, obstacle courses. And then everything's going to be broken down. So we have the bleachers. We have a lawn area where people can bring their blankets and chairs.
Yeah,
and
I was
just
going
lay
to ask
out on the bowl
about that to find out, because, you know, kind of like a la Ravinia, the people that are always wanting to be out there, or they're assigned out there, or they pay for the lawn seats out there, or just places on the lawn where they can stretch out and bring their snacks and sit there and
just
enjoy
hang
themselves.
Out, man. And then we're going to have standing room only for GA, and then we have our VIP pit, which is a standing room stage front pit for our VIP attendees. So
now, for people that are interested, we've been talking about the acts and talking about the other things that are important for a music festival, like food.
Absolutely.
For sure. To be sure, how about the ticket situation? Where can people get tickets and so things that they need to know here before the event on June 1st?
So our tickets are broken into separate tiers. We have tier 1, 2, and 3. Tier 1 is already sold out. We sold out our VIP and our GA Tier 1 tickets. So right now Tier 2 is on sale, and you can get those at hometowncountryjam.com. And it's real easy. Eventbrite, we went with Eventbrite because it's low processing fees. Mm-hmm. You know, unlike Ticketmaster, you got to pay $10 extra on top of the ticket. It's only like $2 or $3 for their processing fees. So we're like, we wanted to go for them. And really, we wanted to keep the prices low. You know, you go to these major festivals in Chicago, and it's over $100, you know, and it's you're spending almost, you know, half your paycheck if you want to take your family to a concert. So we wanted to bring the Chicago feel here, you know, with the big stage, the big acts, for half the price. So that was our goal.
No one probably not only the entertainment value, but probably one of the most important things to note is that there's going to be a Northwest Indiana nonprofit that's going to help benefit from the proceeds.
That tell is, us, that tell is us the about most that. Exciting
and
part.
How did you get them involved in this?
Funny story. My girlfriend, actually, she loves animals. And she goes, you know, what if you got the Humane Society involved? And I was like, that's perfect. So I reached out to the Humane Society of Hobart, and they're completely on board. They're going to be on site. I think they have some awesome things planned. They're not going to be able to have the dogs on site and cats, unfortunately, but they're going to have, you know, the flyers and possibly some on-site adoptions, maybe some discounts if you want to adopt on site. Those logistics are still being worked out, but we're really excited to have them involved. They're going to get a percentage of all the proceeds. I really wanted to have that charity aspect involved with the festival.
Well, it's nice to know that the Humane Society of Hobart is very much, not only they'll appreciate getting a share of the proceeds, but also that they're very much involved with the project. Since this is the inaugural event, I'm making the assumption that you're planning for more of these after this one this summer.
That is the plan. I would love to expand on not only this festival, but the opportunity to bring other acts to Hobart, Indiana, to Northwest Indiana, whether if it's a rock event or, you know, a pop event. And we really have the opportunity to just grow from here. So definitely want to continue with the Hometown Country Jam in the years to come and watch out for other concerts to come as well.
That's great. Well, Tyrus, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about the
Thanks,
event coming
Chris.
Up. Tyrus Josephorski is the organizer of the Hometown Country Jam. It's a country music festival. It's going to be held on June 1st, which is a Saturday, by the way, and it'll be held at the historic Bricky Bowl in Hobart, Indiana.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.